Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with Dr. Don Boudreau and Professor Margaret Somerville from McGill University about their clinical discussion piece in the New England Medical Journal, Physician-Assisted Suicide Should Not Be Permitted, or
this
Should It?
Well, I think they have a strong belief that it should not, and I think this is an important conversation that will resonate with everyone out there, because we all at some point in time may be faced with this type of decision in our family, in our lives. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
I am too. But first, we do have some research that matters. We're going to talk about ADHD drugs and kids' grades.
So whether or not they improve it or not, something I want to know about as we get older, are we willing to accept help from others?
And about soy and whether it prevents prostate cancer return.
And then finally, returning to geriatrics and elder care, the aging of America. What does this mean for disability in the final days of life? We've got lots of interesting research here, Christy.
I know. Well, we'll go back to talking about kids' grades and ADHD drugs. And these medicines for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, are thought to boost kids' performance in school. And a lot of people take stimulants like Ritalin and Adderall to try to help people focus better and do perform to the best of their ability in school.
And if you asked me before I read this study, does it help grades? I would have said, well, certainly, because we know that it does help memory and helps attention. But this particular research study of 4,000 students to our neighbors of the north in Quebec over an average period of 11 years found that boys who took these medication did not perform better in the school, the boys and the girls, than those who didn't take these medicines. It wasn't like these medicines helped their grades improve. And this was a working paper published on the website of the National Bureau of Economic Research.
And in fact, the boys who took the ADHD medicines actually performed worse in school than the boys who had similar symptoms but didn't take medications for it. And so it really is puzzling if the medicines are supposed to improve attention, focus, self-control, help people not be so distracted in school, it just makes sense that the grades would go up. And so why don't the grades improve?
And I guess one of the ways of interpreting these findings is that, and this actually does make sense, is that the medicines are effective at helping classroom behaviors like sitting still and not, you know, blurting in front of the teacher. It allows us not to blurt in front of each other, Christy, as well. But it doesn't seem to help with the main factors that are really associated with good grades, like completion of homework, the family encouragement, all of those things that probably are so much more important.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly more study needs to be done. I mean, we've got 2.7 million children in America that were taking ADHD medications in 2007, which is probably higher now. So this affects a lot of people, and I think we need to understand better what the long-term and short-term effects really are.
And this doesn't mean that you should, any parent out there, stop your child's ADHD medications. But perhaps if the decision was to start them because you thought the grades would improve, may not be, even though it may help with their focus, concentration, and some in-class behaviors, which are all important things.
So this next research that matters is about adults who may not care for themselves. And it's really a common problem in older adults that we refer to as self-neglect, where people choose, for a variety of reasons, not to care for themselves in the way that others would expect them to.
And this is a really difficult issue, Christy. I remember someone that my team was taking care of in the hospital recently who was self-neglecting themselves at home. And there was so much difficulty because the family members didn't really want to help because the person wasn't taking care of themselves. They blamed the patient for some of their behaviors. And yet there was also profound depression and other mental illness happening. This is difficult for doctors and for patients.
It is. And it really speaks to the importance of having a team or connecting older people into interdisciplinary care, including social workers or physical therapists or other behavioral medicine people who can help us really as providers understand the full social context and how that overlaps with mental health or other factors that could contribute.
So if you or know of a loved one out there or a friend or family member who is maybe elderly or maybe not so elderly and has stopped bathing, stopped eating, maybe stopped cleaning their homes, taking medications, having difficulty with their finances, maybe not taking the garbage out, maybe not even showing up at doctor's appointments. Let your doctor, a healthcare provider, a social worker know, because this patient, your friend, your family member may be suffering from self-neglect, and this team-based approach that you mentioned, Christy, right on target.
Okay, let's do our next research that matters. And this is about soy and prostate cancer. So a lot of people have prostate cancer, a lot of men, obviously. And there's been some suggestion that compounds in soy, and we've talked about them on the show before, Adam, these isoflavones may help prevent prostate cancer. So lots of people are trying whatever they can, and soy-based products is something prostate cancer survivors have been trying.
And this article that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association really was about, could it prevent recurrence or progression? So patients with prostate cancer, 177 men who had had their prostates surgically removed, and they were either assigned to drink a soy beverage every day for up to 2 years, or not to drink that soy beverage.
And basically, they found that the same it was the same in both groups. Whether you took the soy or not, the return of the prostate cancer was about the same in both groups, which really adds to, I mean, we keep talking about these different supplements and the lack of really promising studies in a lot of cases that nutritional supplements are really beneficial.
And so, at least in this particular case, if you enjoy soy, there's no evidence that it's
probably
worse
fine.
For you, and it's probably fine. If you like your tofu, can keep eating it, as I do, to be disclosed fully. But we're going to have to look for more research about prostate cancer. What about our very last research that matters, Christy?
Okay, this was a study that came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine Journal about what to expect and what really happens as we live longer.
And this was from the Health and Retirement Study, a research that was funded by the National Institute of Aging. And they looked at over 8,000 people who died over the course of the study, and particularly what had happened to them in the last 2 years of their life, because as the population ages, this is a critical issue.
Yeah, they had interviewed the study participants every 2 years about their health and their economic well-being, and found that the older the person was when he or she died, the more likely the person was to wind up disabled in their general activities of daily living in those last 2 years of life.
Right. So the difficulties that we maybe take for granted when we're younger, like dressing and bathing and eating, getting in and out of bed, using the toilet, just walking across the room, these are progressively more difficult. And as we get into our 80s and 90s, there's a significant number of us who actually need help towards the end of our lives with these activities. I don't think it's something that we're prepared for in our training, Christy, because we haven't talked as much about it in our training and in society.
I would agree. We certainly need to do a better job preparing our workforce for the growing aging population. But I also think, you know, we all sort of expect old age to be this lovely thing in our minds. And there are times where we maybe need to adjust those expectations a bit and plan for having additional assistance in those later years. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Don Boudreau and Professor Margaret Somerville about their article, Physician-Assisted Suicide Should Not Be Permitted. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Don Boudreau, Director of the Office of Curriculum Development at McGill University, and Dr. Margaret Somerville, Founding Director of the McGill Center for Medicine, Ethics, and Law, about a recent, very interesting clinical discussion piece they had in the New England Journal of Medicine about physician-assisted suicide. Welcome to Your Health.
Thank you.
I wonder, and either of you, Dr. Boudreau, perhaps you could start. Tell us the story of how you decided to write this piece and how you became so passionate about this topic of physician-assisted suicide.
Okay. Well, in a previous position, I was the associate dean at McGill University School of Medicine, responsible for the medical student program. And during my tenure as associate dean for about 8 years, we decided to reorient the curriculum towards the healer role of the physician. The physician is a healer. And then when I finished that responsibility, then they became in charge of curriculum development. I realized that in our particular jurisdiction, the government was promoting physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. And then it struck me that I would have a really difficult time promoting a curriculum focused on healing and at the same time preparing our medical students to be euthanologists or euthanatists or whatever word you want to use for them. So that's why I became interested. I just realized that there was a huge disconnect for me. On one hand, having to prepare students for the healer role. On the other hand, potentially having to prepare them and train them and educate them to be euthanologists. So that's how I became interested.
And Dr. Somerville, you direct a center on ethics. This must be one of the issues at the top of what people care about.
I think, and I've written, that it's the single most important social value issue that we face at the beginning of the 21st century, and that whether we decide that we will maintain over 2,000 years of tradition and history and values, that we don't kill each other and we'll move towards legalizing that and having physicians as the people who carry it out, is an absolutely major societal issue. And I've actually been researching this issue for well over 30 years and writing about it. And you know, I've seen the debate unfold. And what was unthinkable even 10 or 15 years ago is now being implemented in some jurisdictions. And I think it's very important that people realize what that means, not just for the individuals who are concerned, because the strongest case that you can make for euthanasia is at the level of the individual person who's a competent adult who gives informed consent, who's got suffering and who wants it. But when you look at what will be the impact of legalizing this on institutions, and in particular the institutions of medicine and law, and on society itself, that we say, well, at a certain point we will dispose of people who we see as not having a good enough quality of life. That's an incredible change in our social value.
We certainly want to get into some of those issues, but I wonder first if you might, for our listeners, describe a scenario or two. Like, what would be the most common situation that a decision about physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia might come to play?
Should I start first?
Yeah.
Well, okay, sure. Well, Christy, I think that I'm a practicing physician. As I've mentioned, I have had a responsibility for an education program and now working more in administration, but I still am a practicing physician. I'm a pulmonologist, a respiratory physician. And in my field, there are very few circumstances in which I would ever have to be faced with a request for a physician-assisted suicide. It just doesn't happen. It's very, very rare. It's extraordinarily rare. However, if you look at our society and in our province, in Quebec, the people who have gone forward and advocating for physician-assisted suicide are usually, in my experience, usually have been people with progressive degenerative neurological conditions. So people who see themselves slowly losing their functional abilities, slowly losing their abilities to do their activities of daily living and to function, and eventually even perhaps requiring assistance in respiratory, in breathing, for example. So those are the circumstances. But I personally have never been faced with a request from a patient or by a patient for euthanasia, never. And I've been practicing now for over 30 years. So it's actually extraordinarily rare. Now, I'm not saying that there are not circumstances where suffering is severe, but it's very, very, very rare.
Well, you know, in your New England Journal of Medicine article, you talk about a hypothetical or a patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer, and it brought to mind a patient of mine who had metastatic pancreatic cancer, and the conversations where he was in such pain and suffering, and he did ask me whether it was serious or not, would I just give him a cocktail? And you describe a situation about hearing this request for death, but not carrying it out. I wonder if you could talk, maybe Dr. Somerville, how do you hear this type of request? And what do you do with it?
But I think what you have to do is you've got to ask, what is this patient trying to communicate to me? And the person, I mean, there is nothing worse than being in pain. And I couldn't be a stronger advocate of the principle that everybody's got the right to have fully adequate pain management. And I once volunteered to take a free criminal prosecution, because I'm also a lawyer, as it happens, against any doctor who unreasonably left a person in serious pain. And we now have a new declaration called the Declaration of Montreal, which has been put out by the International Pain Society, and that establishes that there is a human right to have adequate pain management. And so when that person, I mean, if the person really is in serious pain, they're probably asking for euthanasia as a way of telling you, I can't stand this anymore, you've got to do something about it. And I completely agree with that. But when you look at the surveys on people who ask for euthanasia and what are their reasons for asking for it, pain is actually in somewhere around number 14 on a list of reasons. And the top reasons why people ask for euthanasia is that they're frightened of dying alone, they're frightened of being abandoned, they're frightened of being a burden on their families. And sometimes what they're really asking is, do you love me enough to still want to be here and look after me? So it's a very complex situation. There's also research from Dr. Harvey Max Chochinov and his team. He's a psychiatrist who specializes in psychiatry of dying people. And in one of their research projects, they found that people who ask for euthanasia, on average, change their minds every 12 hours. So if you're going to carry this out, you might just get the person in the time frame in which they want it, but 12 hours later, they've changed their mind. So, you know, this whole approach to this, that this is a simple request that you can take at face value, is simply wrong.
That is fascinating. We do need to take a short break, but we will be right back. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, Dr. Don Boudreau and Dr. Margaret Somerville, about physician-assisted suicide. We'll be right back with Your Health. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Don Boudreau and Dr. Margaret Somerville about physician-assisted suicide. And I wonder if you might share a little more with us about the ways or how a physician-assisted suicide breaks ethical norms of doctors. I'm thinking of the example of a patient dying of cancer that's riddled his body and where there's no cure and is requesting to go ahead and end the process of this doctor that he trusts. And if the doctor helps him do so, how does that break ethical principles?
Margo, would you like to take this one?
Yes, I'll start and then maybe you can take it, Don.
Okay.
First of all, the issue in the assisted suicide euthanasia debate is not if we die. Sadly, I think, we're all going to die. The issue is how we die. And where we see this as wrong is that I'm going to put this very bluntly, it's wrong to have physicians killing patients, that's euthanasia when they give a lethal injection, or to helping patients to kill themselves, which is assisted suicide. And I believe that when you look at what is involved there and you look at the proper role of a physician, that simply isn't consistent with what the role of the physician is. And in another article that Dr. Boudreau and I wrote, we wrote, much as we disagree with euthanasia and assisted suicide, we wrote that if society is going to legalize it, the very group that you should not have helping people to do this are physicians. And that's because people need to trust physicians. They need that they're going to care and cure where possible, but never kill.
And
Yes, I totally agree with that. I was going to actually say the same thing. And perhaps just add another sort of layer, if you wish, in terms of a physician. We teach our students, as I mentioned earlier, to be healers. There are many healers in society. There are many healing traditions in society. Physicians is one tradition. It's one particular profession that's a healing profession. And some of the elements of that, some of the characteristics of a healer, is that the healer is expected to be present and accompany the patient. And that means to accompany the patient throughout the trajectory of illness, from the diagnosis to the very bitter end. And you want patients to understand that that's the basic presumption, that that's the basic behavior of a physician. That's what they can expect from a doctor, that the doctor will be accompanying them, will be present with them, will be present to them, and will deeply respect them throughout life and to the very end of life. Now, can you imagine what it's like if a doctor all of a sudden has a dual role? Instead of just being basically there for maintaining health and relieving suffering, he or she is also now the potential euthanologist or the one who is going to sort of push over the edge. That's going to change the fundamental nature of the doctor-patient relationship. And I think that's unfair for the patient. And I think society has to protect that. Society has to protect that fundamental role. And as Dr. Somerville mentioned, it's over 2,000 years old that doctors have been expected to be there and to accompany the patient. And perhaps I may just add something. And again, it may be interesting for your listeners to know this. In those jurisdictions which have legalized assisted suicide, you might ask yourself, well, how often is the doctor present and accompany the patient to the very end? Well, you'll be surprised to know that, for example, in Oregon, when Dying with Dignity Act was first approved, the first couple of years, it was something like 60% of the time the doctors were present at their patient's death. Then a few years ago, it was down to 21%. So gradually, over time, the physicians have distanced themselves from the patient at the time of death. Now, I think you have to ask yourself, why is that? Why have doctors who participate in this change their fundamental behavior. And that's one of my fundamental concerns, that if society approves this, that is going to change the fundamental behavior of physicians. And we don't want that. Society should not put up with that. Society has to protect the fundamental role of the physician as a healer.
Well, I know that
on and on. As you can see, I'm quite passionate about this.
Well, let me ask you a question, and maybe Dr. Somerville, I think we're going to want to know how you think this is going to change, how this debate is going to change the nature of medicine. But it's clear that this is now a debatable topic. There was a debate in the New England Journal of Medicine that essentially says there are two sides to this issue that they give equal weight to. If you were to go 100 years ago compared to now, it's legal in certain jurisdictions. Why is it now debatable? Help us understand that and how you respond to that.
Well, Adam, you've got to put it into a much wider context to understand that. We're talking about the culture wars, and that those are the wars between people who still believe in traditional values and the people who are promoting so-called progressive values. And when you look at the underlying sort of informing principle of these progressive values, it's radical individual autonomy. And what that says is that I've got the right to decide for myself. It's that question in the euthanasia context. It's the question, it's my body, it's my death, and nobody else has got the right to tell me when I can or can't die or how I can or can't do it. And so it really what we have in the euthanasia debate with the values conflict is a conflict between maintaining the value of respect for human life, which requires that we don't intentionally take human life, the one exception being where it's the only way to save human life, such as in justified self-defense. That's the value on the traditional side, whereas the value on the so-called progressive value side is individual autonomy. I want to die. I want somebody to give me a lethal injection or give me the means to kill myself, and therefore I've got a right to this. So that's where the conflict is coming from. But it's that conflict is not just in that area. It's spread through society. It's, for example, it's got to do with whether people should be allowed to use marijuana or not. There's all sorts of things that it's affecting.
Another quick question. These are all difficult, so not quick. But do you think or do you worry that if this were legalized in isolated rare cases, that it would open doors further for euthanasia of vulnerable populations like people with mental health or other disabilities?
Chrissy, maybe I can answer that. The answer is a clear, absolute yes. We've got the best examples. We've got are Belgium and the Netherlands. And as I told you, I've been following this issue for over 30 years. And when it started in the Netherlands, you had to be a competent, consenting adult in unrelievable pain and suffering. You had to consistently ask for euthanasia over a period of time. And now none of those conditions apply. The Netherlands has recently authorized euthanizing disabled newborn babies. In Belgium, people who are not terminally ill, for example, a couple, the man was seriously ill, old couple, they'd been married for 60 years. The woman wasn't ill at all, but she wanted to die with her husband. They gave both of them euthanasia.
Oh, that's concerning.
As well in the Netherlands, they've recently had cases that have been, sorry, not the Netherlands, Belgium. They've had cases that have been reported in the medical journals of taking organs for transplant after euthanasia. So if you want to know whether we get used to this and we think we should use it and people don't give consent to it, the answers are clear yes.
Well, Dr. Summer, we need to thank you. We're going to need to wrap up. And we do want to thank you and Dr. Boudreau. I think your words at the beginning of the show about really hearing and listening, and I think your challenge to physicians to be there at the time of death, I think those are wise words. And I just really want to thank you both for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's been a pleasure to speak to you, and I hope that it's useful for your audience as well, and really, it's been a delight.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Adam and Christy. Nice to talk to you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to let us know our very first house call question today about hand, foot, and mouth disease.
My child's daycare had a case of hand, foot, and mouth disease. How can I prevent my child from contracting it?
Well, you could take your child out of daycare.
You could.
Probably not an option, though, is it?
Well, it's tricky because the virus that causes hand, foot, and mouth disease, the Coxsackie virus, it is contagious. It is something that, you know, if you're putting your hands in your mouth, and certainly a lot of children, when you have this happen in a daycare setting, it's really hard to say, hey, children, wash your hands and stop putting toys in your mouth.
However, there is some really good research that having children in daycares and the daycare providers wash their hands mm-hmm. really frequently and having access to this anti-germ soap that you can put on your hands frequently, that can cut down on all sorts of viral illnesses, including the hand, foot, and mouth disease.
And the truth is, most kids will get hand, foot, and mouth disease and feel lousy, but get better just like they do from most viruses. And so if your child does catch it, it's, you know, sad and you want to prevent it, but most kids do just fine.
There is some evidence that getting flu shots in the fall and winter can cut down on respiratory illnesses in general, not necessarily the hand, foot, and mouth disease in particular, but kind of a herd type immunity. And so we do encourage in the appropriate season that you get the flu shot. There's not a whole lot of other preventive things, but let's do what we can do.
Let's take our very next house call question.
I have a friend who is diabetic but drinks alcohol on a daily basis. Isn't this harmful?
Well, certainly it can be harmful. If you have diabetes, well, there are a couple different things. One point I would make is that when you drink alcohol, it has usually a high sugar load, and so that can affect your control of your blood sugar if you're drinking sort of sugary drinks. Most beer, wine, other alcoholic beverages have a lot of sugar in them.
And it's hard to know, like, how much alcohol is being drunk here. You know, if you were having a glass of wine once a day, we might say one answer. If you're having three glasses of wine, or as one of my patients recently told me, they were having three scotches every single day, that's a little bit more than perhaps we're comfortable with.
And also, if you have diabetes and you were to get really drunk from intoxication or overuse of alcohol, it can make things especially complicated, and you could get very sick and even life-threatening kind of sick. So I would be cautious.
Yeah, the alcohol abuse can lead to excess acid production. The diabetes can lead to diabetic ketoacidosis. Acidosis doesn't sound very good, and it's not very good. And when you combine acid from one source and acid from another source, you can get an acid overload. That's really bad under any condition.
That's bad. Okay, so tell your friend to be careful and talk to his doctor about it.
Let's listen to our very next house call, Erica.
I sleep between 5 and 6 hours per night, and I know that my body is sleep deprived. I try to catch up on the weekends. Is this still bad?
Oh, I'm sorry you're not getting very much sleep during the week. That, coming from physicians who often don't get enough sleep, it's rough and can be really stressful to not be able to sleep.
Well, the interesting thing here is that you are aware that you are sleep deprived. And I think most people are aware they're sleep deprived. And I think the real gap here is, what do you do about that? And I guess your first question here is, well, can I play catch up? And I think if you are playing catch up, that's better than not playing catch up. You know, if you are at least getting some additional sleep, the problem is the stress of chronic sleep deprivation, is it wiped out on Saturday and Sunday? I don't think it's completely wiped out, Christy. What do you think?
Probably not. Most people need about 9 hours of sleep a night. That's right, not eight, but nine. And most people, certainly in America, don't get that much. We know you cannot store up sleep, like sleep a lot on the weekend because you know the following week you're not going to sleep very much. And I think catching up is a good idea when you can do it. But I'd really want to address, why is it that you can only sleep 5 to 6 hours a night? And is there anything that we could do, whether it's job shifting or if it's insomnia, or there are sleep strategies to help you try to get more sleep during the week?
Right. A lot of people can't have to get up at work at a certain time, mm-hmm. but where you have control is when you go to bed at night. And if you go to bed at 11 o'clock and get in bed and watching 1 hour of Law and Order about the worst known tragedies affecting families of sexual predators, and then think you're going to sleep real good 5 or 6 hours and get up, no. Go to sleep at 9 o'clock before those episodes come on.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. We wish you the best. And do you think that you can work with a therapist or your physician to try to figure out ways to improve what's called sleep hygiene? We'll ask our health sciences librarians to put up some tips about sleep hygiene on our website.
So we've had hand hygiene earlier, now sleep hygiene. Let's have our very last house call, Erica.
What causes delayed muscle soreness after a workout?
Well, this is one that Christy and I, we were talking to each other earlier as we walked in the studio today about how we were both sore, though we didn't say why we were both feeling muscle sore.
I'm sore because I've been exercising, doing CrossFit, weightlifting, and all kinds of crazy exercises. So I'm very sore from the lactic acid that builds up in our muscles when we use them to their fullest potential.
And I am sore, Christy, because I went on a 7-mile hike on Saturday, climbing the mountain for 3.5 miles straight up and then 3.5 miles down over about 5 hours. And then Sunday, I just did the simple 5-mile hike. That would be fine if I was used to those sorts of activities. But my calves and my gluteal muscles, it feels like someone stuck a knife in both of them. But it didn't hurt so bad when I first got done. It was sore 3 hours, 6 hours a day, and in this case, 2 days later, is really sore.
Well, I think that's pretty typical, where as we're using our muscles, we're increasing the blood flow, and we're using them, and right afterwards, you feel really good. I feel like I could, you know, lift a car and do something extraordinary. But then it's that delayed, once that lactic acid sits in, that starts to make your muscles feel tight and sore until you're able to either get more exercise and work it out or get a massage or just time.
One of the things I did, Christy, that helped at least my calf muscles is when I got done with my hikes, I got ice from the freezer and I gave myself a little ice massage on the calves. And it took away not only the initial pain and inflammation, it seemed to help out with the pain because my calves feel much better today.
I believe you that helps, but that sounds like torture to me. I don't want to be in an ice bath. Was that hard to tolerate?
Not for the calves. I think getting in a full ice bath would have been difficult. A little ice massage. Well, we've given a couple strategies for a few questions, and we thank all of you for your house calls today as we hope we've answered important things to your health.
We want to thank you for joining us today for your health, and we'd love for you to share questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app.
And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guests today, Dr. Don Boudreau and Professor Margaret Somerville. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.